So Diana and I are going to first share some thoughts about bringing the practice home. And I'll talk first about developing and or supporting a daily formal practice. And Diana will talk about the rest of the day, daily life practice. So both are really support each other. You know, formal practice really helps you be mindful throughout the day, and being mindful throughout the day really helps your concentration, your presence, and your daily practice. The one thing about concentration is that it really requires, it's like a muscle. Just like if you lift weights, you know, you get really strong after a while, after you train. And if you stop for 6 months, guess what? You have to start all over. And it's actually the same thing in concentration and in meditation practice. If you don't practice regularly, you lose that muscle. You may not lose the wisdom you've learned, and I don't think you ever lose the wisdom you gained. And even the mindfulness might stay around fairly sharp, but the concentration gets weak. So that's the part that when you formally meditate, that keeps your mind here. And so that's why I really strongly encourage you, you know, if you don't have a daily practice, to consider what you can do to develop it. And if you have a daily practice, sometimes people appreciate ways to refresh it, to re-inspire themselves. Of course, sitting retreat to me, it really re-inspires my practice. So, but there's other things we can do. So having a regular practice, it really helps to have a space that's your regular space, to actually use the power of conditioning. You know, we've all had all this conditioning in our lives that hasn't necessarily been helpful. So this is creating conditioning that is helpful. And the really nice thing about doing something the same time every day, same place every day, is that it really facilitates the grooves in the mind to make it easier to do it every day. And just like, you know, probably none of you have to be nagged into brushing your teeth anymore. You know, the same thing begins to happen. You know, it's like, oh yeah, that's just what I do every day. That's just what I do. So sometimes having an altar can be really helpful, you know, to make your place just a little bit special. And people do all sorts of different things, you know, a flower, a statue. One of my friends, you know, he likes to put dead things on his altar. And, you know, he'll go out for a walk or a hike and, you know, find some, you know, dead leaves or little bones from a dead animal. Or, you know, for him, it's just this daily recollection of the cycles of nature, of the impermanence of life. And for him, that's really inspiring. You know, Ram Dass, you know, he was really working on opening his heart, and he kept on his altar. I don't know if younger people know Kissinger, but it was just somebody politically that most people don't think of metta when they think of them. And, you know, so that for him was like, you know, the reminder that, yes, even there, you know, that's my aspiration, to open my heart even there. So, you know what, you know, so be creative if that's what inspires that, you know. I've done, you know, I have different rituals throughout the years. You know, I used to have this little book that Jack Kornfield and Gill wrote, you know, that's the Buddhist Little Instruction Book, I think. And I used to like read a little passage from there. It's just about that big. I mean, really a little book. And I just read that every morning before sitting. And it was just like my little routine, you know. And you know, I don't use incense because they're not good for our lungs, but I had a long tradition of incense. So I would light it and put it out and smell it, you know. And so then I had that part of the ritual, you know, and it just kind of created this little sweet little atmosphere for me. And again, at different times, different things over the years. And, you know, a couple of other things, it helps, the continuity is really helpful, but so it is not to be rigid. You know, like some people then create a real success and failure thing around it, and they miss a day or something, you know, and then they beat themselves up, and then becomes a duty. And, you know, so one of the things that's helpful is meditate even 5 minutes each day. If you think you're going to skip, do it 5 minutes. You can do it in the car. You know, you can do it while you're waiting for the coffee to get done. You know, there's all sorts of times you could actually put in a few minutes just to maintain the continuity. One of my students, she, you know, she has a really busy life, and she really was very inspired to sit longer periods. And, you know, she's kind of frustrated because she's got kids at home, can't do retreats. And so what we came upon doing is the idea of her on a daily practice, she's doing like 30 to 40 minutes. And then on the weekends, she has time and she can do, you know, she wanted to do like 2 hour sits, you know, and so she would do it on the weekends. It wasn't rigid. It was something that fit her life. Had another one of my students who had a really hard time establishing a practice because his home life, between his kids and his animals, you know, it was really demanding. And so he finally accepted that it was okay to meditate in his car. And so at work, you know, during this, one of his breaks, he would just take half an hour and sit there, you know, and it totally developed this practice sitting in the car. You know, put a little Buddha there and, you know, just made it kind of sweet, you know. So those are the, you know, allow yourself enough flexibility that doesn't, you don't feel oppressed by it. But, you know, and allow some creativity if that's helpful to inspire yourself. You know, one of the places that's particularly challenging sometimes if you travel, and one of the really helpful things is to, you know, you might be in a hotel room where it's, you know, and even with somebody, and one of my students, they would bring like this pretty little scarf they'd put in the corner on the floor, and they would sit there. So that was like their little portable altar. When I went, one thing that inspired me was, you know, I went on a long retreat, you know, and I, you know, it's like, you can't pack that much when you travel across the country. And she gave me a one-inch Buddha. And, you know, I had it on my windowsill. And it was so, you know, the fact that she gave it to me, and it was just very inspiring for me to see it every morning when I got up from on my windowsill. So all these little sweet things we can do to create that, the container that supports us. One of the real supports, and some of you who live in the Bay Area are really fortunate, is that there's Sangha here. There's a lot of community here to practice with, and that's really supportive for practice. But, you know, if you have even a friend, one friend who practices, when I was teaching this online course, you know, I remember these two friends who lived in different time zones, but they found a time they could meditate together. And they would just call each other and say, I'm going to go sit. And they go, oh, me too. And hang up, you know, but they would, every day, they would get that phone call every day. And they both developed this really strong practice. You know, and there's apps too, for some people that's really helpful. You know, I often use for my timer, Insight Timer, you know, I just like the gong in it, but it also shows you who else is meditating online at that time. And there's like tons of people meditating online, which is kind of sweet. I have on occasion just kind of looked and gone, oh, wow, you know, this is really, inspiring to see that. So, You know, and you probably have all done inspiring reading and Dharma talks, you know, but really bring him to your life consciously, you know, to help you with sustaining that. You know, find out what works for you, what supports you. And, you know, and as I said, it can change over time. Sometimes what's and really it gives me a lot of juice for maybe a year, and all of a sudden just like, yeah, you know. And so something else that brings that aliveness to me. And which brings me to those of you who do have a regular practice, you know, and sometimes, you know, we've been doing it for so long, we get complacent. I found that taking time and, you know, I'm going to say each year, but who knows how often, is to really connect with our deepest aspirations in life and really what's really important in life. And one of the things that I found in myself that every time I've done that, it would be some version of the same thing, right? You know, what do I want? I want freedom. I want peace of mind. I want, you know, but each time it might have a different flavor, you know, so that, you know, like I remember being very inspired. The Dalai Lama said, my religion is kindness. And, you know, and that really inspired me for a long time. Like that was like the kind of the theme of my practice was like connecting with kindness, you know, and just taking that time to really reflect and connect with it in a really genuine way is to me one of the great supports in practice. Sometimes we just kind of lose that connection. And of course, retreat practice, you know, for me, you know, and, you know, all of Diana, all of his teachers, retreat practice has always been like such a deep inspiration in our practice, you know, and as a teacher, I learned just as much teaching as I've learned sitting, you know, so it's always been this amazing, honor to be able to teach. You know, it's been so so deepening for my own practice. So I think that's, you know, that's good for right now. So thank you.
Thank you, Inez. So I'm going to talk a little bit about practice that's outside of when you're sitting on the cushion, off the cushion, so to speak. So kind of like in daily life. And one thing that I'll say, I think I said this to one of the groups earlier today, is that there will be some momentum coming off of this retreat. And then just mindfulness will arise and you'll feel embodied and you'll feel like really present for whatever it is you're doing, putting the food on the plate or washing your hands, brushing your teeth, whatever it might be. And when that arises, just because it's going to, we're not making it arise. When it does arise, just appreciate it and notice it. Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm mindful again. This is what it's like to be embodied. And maybe it only lasts for 2 seconds or something like this. But there's something about turning towards and appreciating and like feeling into the experience that makes it easier and easier for the mind to find its way back there. And this, especially if it's associated with some appreciation, a little bit of uplift, something like this. So when this, it's going to happen, and when it does happen, just appreciate it and acknowledge it. So that's one thing. Something else we can do that is to be a little bit intentional, and I learned this from Andrea Fella, is to choose an activity that you do once or twice a day and set the intention that you'll be mindful for this activity. Good examples are brushing the teeth, making the bed, doing the dishes, these types of things that we do every day. And just say, okay, for these next 2 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever, I'm going to be mindful. So bring some curiosity and some embodiment to. And for me, I chose that brushing my teeth. And I initially when I did this, and I was thinking like, wow, what does toothpaste really taste like? And, you know, the feeling of the toothbrush in the mouth or the weight of the toothbrush in the hand, you know, these types of things, just to be present for this. It doesn't have to be complicated, but it's just this activity of bringing the mind into something intentionally. So here we've been doing the breath, but we can do the weight of a toothbrush or something like this. So often what happens is we will set this intention and then we will completely forget. And then when we go to sleep, like, oh, right, I was going to do that mindfulness teeth brushing thing. That's okay. The next day, like, okay, today I'm going to do it. Chances are you'll forget the second day as well. But what happens is we just kind of keeping setting like the intention and then it will happen. It will start to click. So don't expect, you know, perfection from the beginning. And this isn't necessarily going to be easy and all of a sudden you're going to start doing it. But it's just something about setting this attention repeatedly happens. And then for me, I started with teeth brushing after I kind of got the hang of that for quite some time. Then I thought, okay, dishwashing. And to feel the temperature of the water and what does it feel like to have wet hands or things sometimes if they're soapy or just there's so many different textures involved with this. So now I have like both teeth brushing and dishwashing, right? And then for me, it's like after some months, then you can choose a third thing, making the bed or something. So in this way, you just start to, without a lot of extra stress, just start to pepper or sprinkle in your life, sometimes of really being mindful. And we shouldn't underestimate how powerful this can be. It just starts to become easier and easier as the mind gets more and more accustomed to being present for what's actually happening. So that's one thing to do. A second thing that you might consider is to choose an activity that is done more often than just once or twice a day, but is something that is very brief. Some examples are walking through doorways. Just notice when you walk through doorways. Like just bring your attention to what it's like to have the body moving through space through a doorway. Or the experience of sitting down in a chair or whatever. Right? We kind of stand up and sit down a number of times. Or maybe walking to the bathroom or walking to the kitchen or walking to a short distance that's often done more than once or a number of times a day. And again, just set the intention. I'm going to be mindful for this experience. And of course, what you've been cultivating here on retreat with the walking meditation and the work meditation is part of that is to build this bridge over to the things that we do in our daily life. Because chances are you don't spend so many hours a day sitting quietly with your eyes closed, right? So this part of it is just to bring the practice into what it is that you're doing. And then maybe one last thing that I'd like to say here is, and that is about this idea of, I'm going to call it like digital wellness. And that is just to think about this mindfulness to the way in which you're using technology. Sometimes we're using our technology a lot. And I don't want to say anything that it's bad. I just want to say it's an opportunity for us to bring some awareness. Is this supporting my values? Is this supporting what's important for me? The amount of time that I use or what I do with my technology, is it helping me to have my best life? And so this can be an inquiry. It's astonishing. I just looked up the statistics here that there's, I can't find it here in my notes. Oh, I remember. The average person in the United States in 2023 picks up and looks at their phone 96 times a day. That's a lot. It's almost like every 10 minutes on average. It doesn't mean that's what all of you guys are doing, but in America, this is what's happening. When they measure how many times a person touches their phone, So this includes like touching it in your pocket or moving it to somewhere else or something like this. Over 2,000 times a day, people are touching their phones. So it's just to have an inquiry about the way that you're using technology. Is there a way that it can support you? There are plenty of apps. Maybe you know this, right? For me, I noticed that I was paying a little bit too much attention to something in particular on my phone. And I made my phone be black and white, which you can do with phones. And it was really, had a big impact. Like, oh, no, everything's black and white. So it's more, it's less, you know, calling me or something. And it's more functional. Or there's ways, right, you can set timers where, you know, like bedtime mode where it doesn't ring or it turns black and white for certain hours of the day or something like this. Or maybe it's not your phone. Maybe it's the hours, you know, watching YouTube on the computer or something. Just an encouragement to just have an inquiry with yourself. Is this supporting the life that I want to have? This recognition, there are a lot of people that get paid a lot of money to make it as compelling as possible. This is their job, right? And I don't want to demonize that, but it doesn't mean that we have to go along with it. We can choose whether we want to or not. So I just want to bring this kind of like the mindfulness is another place where we can practice mindfulness is our relationship with our devices. And to recognize that we spend a lot of time. The average person in 2023 in the United States spent over 5 hours a day on their phone. That's a lot of time. That's counting the time in which you're using Insight Timer for meditating. So just something to consider. I just want to offer this, something to bring some attention to as we make this transition back to daily life. And now I'd like to open it up just to some questions about what Inez and I have said or about other questions about the retreat, the instructions we gave, Dharma talks, or some of these things. Is there some time for some questions?
Inez, you mentioned mindfulness and concentration, and just building that skill. I'm curious if you, in terms of insight and concentration practices, do you see them as two skills that work in tandem, or do you see them as two sides of the same coin? And then in terms of like concentration practices that are taught in this tradition, like deeper concentration practices, what do you think about that? If you have any thoughts.
So I see that there are two aspects of training the mind that are different, but they work together. And there's different traditions, even the Vipassana tradition, that they train strictly in concentration by itself in a way. And you know, the way that I've done a little bit of training that way myself, but I felt much more at home in working with them together. And it takes a little bit longer to develop the concentration, but to me, it just felt more whole. But I got a lot of value of doing, spending some time really focused on concentration only. I took a month where that's what I did, and just strictly only concentration practice. And it was very helpful for me, for what was happening in my life. But for me, had to do with dealing with pain. You know, it got me past some major pain stuff, not that the pain's gone, but it's just not a problem. And So, you know, it's, you know, there's a lot to be said about this, you know. But for instance, you know, whenever, usually if I sit a longer retreat, my first 3 days of a longer retreat will always be strict concentration. You know, I mean, unless something really comes up, but it'll be, you know, but it'll be strictly concentration so that I get really settled. Or sometimes what I've done, like before one really long retreat, I just do a lot of extra sitting like 2 weeks before the retreat. And so when I start the retreat, my body doesn't have to adapt, you know, to the sleepiness, to the body aching, to the stuff that in you know, it's the one thing always with a short retreat like this, I have a lot of empathy for all of you who have spent a day with a lot of sleepiness and aching bodies and, you know, but, you know, so those are some of the thoughts, you know, without going too deeply there.
Thank you.
Similar question.
And say your names, please.
Cameron. Cameron. Similar but different. One of the aspects of meditation practice that was compelling to me is the idea that you can, in daily life, in a free flowing situation, have more of a pause between what's happening and what you want to do about it. And I'm wondering if that's just a side benefit. Maybe this is just a definitional question, in which case it's a dumb question. But is that just a side benefit of being able to drop into mindfulness, or is it actually a kind of mindfulness?
Maybe I think about it, it's like when we're embodied, then we're not just automatically just reacting. But if we're kind of like present for what's happening, the pause gets shorter and shorter, but there's still this like this awareness, or we're not getting pulled or pushed around so much by what's happening. And so we're able to come from a place that has more settledness and maybe some more wisdom with it. Is this helpful?
Is that? Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Lish, we planned this, that you would go from one side to the next side.
No, my question is it too hot? Should I turn on the AC? And now you're making me walk back.
I'm Meadow. I was wondering if you could maybe repeat the acronym, the RAFT acronym that you said the other day, as far as the, what each word or letter stood for.
Recognize, allow, feel in the body, and tease apart the reaction or the experience from our reaction to the experience.
Thank you.
So,
say your name,
please. My name is Mahesh. So, this is a follow-up to the question on concentration and wisdom. So the mindfulness of breathing that we do, does it fall into concentration or wisdom? And when you say you specifically practiced concentration practices, what was that? What was the practice and what was the wisdom one? I ask this because when you look at other traditions like Goenka or Mahasi Sayadaw, there is a clear distinction between concentration and wisdom practices. You start with concentration and then move. So here I'm not very clear on when we do mindfulness of breathing, like how does it transform later on?
Yes, and that's what I was saying. The way we've been doing it is we do them together, because you need, you know, just staying with the breath, for instance, develops concentration. But if you really pay attention to the quality of the breath and the relaxation, you're developing mindfulness. If you want to just to develop concentration, just notice the breath, notice the breath, notice the breath. It doesn't matter if you see a lot of detail. So with the mindfulness added to it, you see a relationship to it. We see the you know, what's around the breath. So one of the methods that I used for developing concentration was using pleasure. and you find a part in the body that's pleasurable. And, you know, this is guided by a teacher who does this. There's more to it than I can do in a short question. But that's how that particular training is done. And so use the pleasure as instead of the breath to focus until your mind gets still and absorbed. You can do with the breath. You can do it with another teacher I studied with. What's called the Kasina practice, which is looking at a disc, it's a white disc, and so it's really about being one pointed, and then mindfulness practice is about noticing the details of the experience and noticing the more of the range of the experience, you know, what else is happening here, how's the relationship, and when we do them together, you know, you always need some mindfulness to do concentration, otherwise you don't even know you're off the breath. So there's always a little bit, but this is a kind of a pretty equal, this much of each.
So on the mindfulness of breathing, I'm not clear how it is not a concentration practice, because when you see in other traditions as well, they say like follow the breath at the nostrils. We're doing the same thing, right? Like, where is the mindfulness part?
So, for instance, we use it for the entire retreat often, or for big parts of it. And so at the first beginning, you know, we take anything else that happens, we background it. Right? So that's concentration. You're just backgrounding. Anything else happens? No, back to the breath. If a strong emotion comes up in the beginning, I'll say back to the breath. I'm not ready. I'm not settled enough to meet it, you know. But as the days go on and my mind's beginning to settle, then the strong emotion arises. I turn to it and I tend it. And then when it passes, I go back to the breath. If a strong sensation arises, I'll attend that, come back. Sometimes you get lost in a thought and it's a thought train. I'll notice, thinking, that's what's happening, and go back. Whereas in straight concentration, you don't even say, that's what distracted me. You just go back. So it's does that give you a better sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Great.
I was thinking maybe I'll just say a little something, like with concentration practice, that there's a lot that can be said here, but maybe with concentration we tend to be a little bit more like, I'm just going to be with the breath here, and there's this word I'm looking for that just slipped my mind, but we're just with the breath, and just as Inez said, we're kind of like pushing away some things. Whereas mindfulness, we're more like bringing everything in, whether it's a compelling thing or it's thoughts or an emotion or something like this. So we're still using the breath as an anchor for both, but for concentration, we're not really having the mind waver or wander or something like this. Whereas with mindfulness, we are intentionally leaving the breath and going to something else, and then coming back to the breath. So there's a sense of whether it's exclusive or inclusive. Those were the words I was looking for. So thank you, Mahesh.
Sorry.
No, it's good for me. Thank you.
I don't quite have this figured out, this question, but it's something about, can you talk about a little bit about stability and strength and how you see those as similar or not similar when we talk about the stability to be able to hold an emotion, say, is that what we talk about when we're talking about strength too? Is it basically stability?
She's referring to something we talked about in the group about the inner strength. You know, this isn't like so much a Buddhist term. You know, it's not meant that way. Where stability is a very clearly something we develop in practice, and you know, we can develop a lot of meditative stability, but not emotional strength. You know, so emotional strength is a different quality. To be able to be strong and allow all our emotions. Mm. It's a way of, sometimes we associate strong emotions with weakness, with being vulnerable, but not in a healthy way, you know, not vulnerable in a, you know, there's a way to be vulnerable in that we're open to other people and vulnerable that we might be hurt, but with enough strength to know that we can hold that in our lives. You know, so it's a matter of connecting. It's a felt sense. It's a felt sense. So how does that feel? You know, it's not something I can specifically point to. You know, this is how you develop it. But we can all connect with that for a moment. We know the difference between, you know, I can stand on my own 2 feet. You know, I can be there. And if this really difficult thing has to go through me, I can meet it. You know, and so it's a confidence that comes, and you know, now in the more practice related term, every time that we really meet dukkha, that we really meet our own suffering, really with our eyes open, and we don't push it away. Every time we do that, even if we don't do it fully, that, you know, whatever dukkha shows up, if we just are willing, that begins to develop that strength. That really begins to develop that confidence. And every time we do, we survive it, right? And that gives us more confidence. So that's kind of the more direct way of that I'm referring to.
Thank you. Yeah, that's what I was... Yeah.
Thank you. I'm Arya. I'm going to stick to this concentration topic because I have a personal experience with it, and I'm wondering if you can share some insight, maybe a form of affirmation, or maybe that plus. Okay. So years ago when I was thinking about concentration, I was listening to a teacher. And the method that worked for me that I could use as a framework was, emotions come or thoughts come and grab onto the closest umbrella you can think of. Okay, this is about money. Move on. Back to breath. Okay, this is about family, work, etc. But the goal was to abandon it and go back to the breath. But what I found different from the teachings, I think Bruni put it in a way that resonated with me, was it's coming. Don't treat it like an unwelcome guest. Have a cup of tea with it. And then and don't judge it. And stay like that mountaintop. It may be stormy, it may be breezy, but just let it pass, but don't get rid of it. Don't push it away. Don't do anything. Just let it be. And it's working better for me now. Although I don't know if I would be able to do this now had I not done the concentration straight up in the past.
So maybe I'll say a few things. Thank you, Arya. There's a way in which we can do concentration practice where we are just with the object and this subtle aversion arises towards everything that's pulling us away from our object. And it starts, or the concentration, you can build concentration this way, but it's brittle and fragile. It's like, it's if there's any other noise or something, there's a like this little irritation that can arise. So this idea of like just having a cup of tea with it is this opposite of trying to make it go away. And then plus what Inez was saying, that concentration really requires some well-being, some spaciousness, and actually like happiness, like in the Buddha's teachings, happiness is one of the conditions for it to unfold. And so it's not uncommon. I speak from a lot of experience of strive. I got to get concentrated, you know, and it's just awful because I ended up like hating everything because it was distracting me from, you know, what I was trying to do. So this idea of having a cup of tea with it is right, is that there's an ease, a sense of well-being, some spaciousness, but also like a commitment. Maybe you might use this word like, okay, no, I'm just going to keep on coming back. And then allowing a sense of well-being to grow. And I'm going like this with my body because it kind of feels like this. It's like this uplifting, something like that. So. Was that what you were?
Yep.
Thank you, Arya. Maybe, so as Lish is walking up here, maybe I'll say something about, I just wanted to say a little bit of my appreciation to everybody for your practice, for being here, this, you know, what we created together here. It's a beautiful thing. I just, it's very meaningful for me. For my life, I kind of, you know, both Inez and I were kind of like, you know, dedicated to this, sharing the Dharma in a way that's helpful for people and that's supportive. And part of that is IRC. For me, I consider such great good fortune to be part of IRC in this way that we're helping to create the conditions in which people can practice together. And it's okay. And that, you know, and that this is freely offered. So it's everything here is because people care about practice, because people have been inspired, because people have been touched by it, and they want to share it with others. They want to make it available for others. And so, as you know, we're all run by volunteers. That's a beautiful thing. It's very meaningful for me that people bring their skills, their talents, their desire, their aspiration, and they share it with others. And we have this alternative economy here that's like things are freely offered. And if you feel inspired, if something has touched you, if you'd like to share it with others, then you can. It's not a requirement, but it's this way in which we can. In my view, for me personally, it's kind of like being the change I want to see in the world, in which things are shared freely and there's this care and generosity that's available and touches people. And things happen differently when they're in this field of generosity as opposed to, well, you owe me this and I'll do that for you if you do that for me, as opposed to, no, my heart is touched here and I want to share it. So this is part of me just sharing my appreciation for you all and for this fabulous place called IRC. So thank you.